From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Abroad, they've been dubbed by some the Frightful Five. Amazon, Facebook, Google, Apple, Microsoft. They are undisputed world leaders in tech. But there's mounting global pushback against these companies in Europe, in China, in India, beyond. Countries looking to compete, protect their culture, take control of realms that big tech firms transform. It's a challenge, too, to the leading edge of the U.S. economy. This hour, On Point, global pushback to America's tech giants and what it means. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. American tech players, have you run up against this? What's it mean if these U.S. giants hit borders, boundaries? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Late last year, Europe's highest court ruled that Facebook was not protecting its data adequately. Wouldn't work, couldn't happen in Germany. Here's Heiko Maas, German Justice Minister. Says the verdict of the European Court of Justice is a strong signal for more data protection and greater protection of privacy in a globally connected world. And that's just one kind of hurdle that's coming up against these American tech giants. We'll look globally, but joining me first today from Brussels is Nicholas Hurst. He covers competition and antitrust for Politico Europe. You can link to his recent reporting at our website, onpointradio.org. Nicholas Hurst, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
We're reading about battle lines being drawn against American tech giants, and Europe comes up right away. On what fronts has Europe been pushing back against these Google, Amazon, right on to Facebook, right on down?
Well, it's been a bit of a horrible year for tech giants in Europe so far. There's been, if you take Google as a case in hand, it's faced more antitrust problems in Brussels than it was previously. There's a new case which is targeting its Android operating system. In addition, there are the privacy issues that you mentioned, this ruling in Europe's top court that requires Google to take much stronger action to respond to individuals' concerns that there's stuff out there about them that they don't want to be out them. But then on top of those problems, which have been rumbling along for a while in the sort of public discourse and people have known about, Google's also found itself at the center of this tax dispute. And this originated at the start of the year with a tax settlement with the UK tax authorities. But this suddenly brought this issue to light, and it ended up focalizing a lot of European anxiety about the taxes that multinationals pay, and in particular, big American tax companies pay. It ended up focalizing a lot of that anxiety on Google, who ended up being the villain of the narrative, unfortunately, for the company. So it's really been a bit of a tough year for Google. And I think that's true also of the wider, of other, the Frightful Five, as you said, here in Europe.
What's driving this? What lies at the base of it? Is it a desire on behalf of European governments to help their own tech companies compete? Is it a desire to protect cultural norms that might be disrupted by these American tech giants? Is it a sense that they've somehow abused their power?
Well, I think it's there's certainly aspect of the latter. I mean, the rules in Europe are the principles in Europe for many of these laws. So antitrust or potentially privacy or obviously tax as well. Yeah, they're shared across the Western world and with the US. But the way that those principles are detailed are obviously different. And all the more so when you're dealing with companies, innovative companies like this that have come up with new business models that totally challenge the way that we think about things, that the economy works and that the law works. And so to some extent, it reflects the different rules. Antitrust is a case in hand where, as you know, there's antitrust proceedings going on against Google and other companies other tech companies here in Europe. But those cases are not replicated in the US. There's no parallel proceedings in the US, at least in many instances. So it's a question of legal differences, I guess. But as you said, there's also a cultural factor. Perhaps of all the European countries, if you take France illustrates this the best. It's a proud nation that used to be an industrial powerhouse, a political powerhouse. And a nation that is sort of on struggling a little bit to find its new identity in the new economy and the new world. And in France, they talk a lot with great anxiety about what they call le GAFA. Now, the GAFA stands for Google, Amazon, Facebook, Apple. And some people talk about le GAFAM because they add Microsoft in there. But it kind of, this acronym that gets bandied around in the French media sort of encapsulates the French anxiety about these almost sort of faceless tech giants that are rampaging all over the French economy. And, you know, with some good reason, France is this wonderfully creative media sort of mediatized country where it's got great publishing houses and it's got centuries old newspapers and it's got its music industry and a great cinema industry and so on. And, you know, for good or for bad, these tech companies are radically transforming the way that the economy works and so on. And nowhere is that more apparent and more sort of disruptive than France, that does have these very, very well established interests, very well established industries that are being really rattled by the new economy. So there is a cultural element to that. There's a sort of fallen glory or sort of nostalgia for the past. And there is also a sort of economic aspect, you know, some sort of kind of protectionist impulse saying, well, you know, in the new economy, these industries that we're normally good at are not doing so well. And these industries that the US is very good at are doing extremely well. Maybe we need to try and redress that balance one way or another.
The premise behind a lot of these companies was, behind the internet itself, of course, was that it's global and their businesses would be global, kind of seamless around the planet. Now we're seeing strong pushback in China. We're seeing pushback in India. You're describing Europe. Does that business model still hold up for Google, Apple, and others, that whatever they can make, if it's really great, it will just flow right around the world, and that will be the way things are?
Quite. Well, that's the paradox about the European situation in some ways, because, again, no one subscribes more to this ideal of a sort of, you know, of an internet that serves all of humanity and is the same across the entire world and gives humans in the entire world free and ready access to information. So on. No one subscribes more to that than the French, this kind of idealistic people. And yet, at the same time, among all the Europeans, they've almost been the most intransigent in demanding that their principles and their rights and their view of how the internet should interact with people be respected. And just to a large degree, well, let's say that your proposition is correct to some extent at the moment. I mean, really, we're just at the outset. But if you take one example, which is the right to be forgotten. Now, Europe has come up with says that European privacy rules mean that any individual that has information out there on the internet and feels that that information is not correct or not fair or inaccurate or no longer relevant can request Google search engine, of course, to remove links to that information. Now, when those rules were devised, they were devised as European wide. Now, what's happened since then is the French in particular, but also other European countries have said, well, hang on, you know, you need to apply these rules not just to people living in France, but also to French people or to people viewing things about French people from other countries. You should also apply these rules outside France because, of course, people in France have connections to people outside France and could be harmed by what those connections see. And you can see how this quite quickly snowballs into demands that actually end up affecting and sort of fragmenting the way that Google operates at the European level and then also at the international level, and it affects that. And if this is an indication of the way things are going, then yes, I think that over time we will start to see internet companies, websites, providing increasingly fragmented, sort of diverse versions of their services in different countries to cater not just for different tastes, which of course is something that they do at the moment. And they do that just like Apple will promote certain films or certain music in one countries and not the other, which is only natural in some respects, right? But they're going to end up having to do that to also accommodate different rules and laws and so on. And, you know, that may, on the one hand, that may well mean that the general good, the public good, the global good suffers as a result. On the other hand, you know, we shouldn't kid ourselves that these are incredibly savvy, wealthy, complex companies that are very able to deal with complex regulatory environments and different demands and so on. And to some extent, they're already doing that. I mean, if you put a request into Google, Google will detect whereabouts you're making that search request from, and will tailor the results according to where you are. And that's a similar thing that happens with Amazon. You shop on Amazon, it detects where you are and will then present you with a website that reflects that and so on. So yes, fragmentation is a risk, but at the same time, things are not quite so clearly defined at the moment.
Though we're looking at the end of May, even Netflix, not one of the very biggest there, but Netflix being European officials proposing a new set of rules that could force Netflix and other video streaming services to carry a minimum amount of local content in individual countries, help pay for the development of that. Nicholas Hurst, please stand by there in Brussels. It's great to have you here, reporter for Politico Europe. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about a global pushback, you could call it, against American tech industry giants, Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, and more, as countries look to present their own industry and sovereignty to protect it from the dominance of these very big American firms. Nicholas Hurst is with us with Politico in Brussels, and you can join us as well. If you were China, France, India, Brazil, would you want your search run by Google, your social life by Facebook, your phones by Apple, your retailing by Amazon? And what happens to sovereignty, government power, if huge tech giants, American companies, make the rules, the operating systems? Are you in this business? Have you seen the pushback? And we're thinking about what it means for these American giants, for the American economy. People writing lately, Farhad Manjoo, the New York Times, writing about a coming global freakout over the power of the American tech industry. Nicholas Hurst, please stand by in Brussels. With us right now as well from Washington is Jane Wynn, professor of law at the University of Washington. She's an expert in the impact of tech innovation on national legal systems. Jane Wynn, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
So why are we suddenly talking about a coming global freakout over the power of the American tech industry?
The ability of national governments to exercise exclusive control over regulation of business activity within their borders has been declining for a long time. And for a lot of countries, less developed countries that were formerly colonies, they never actually had that degree of control over their territories. So what's happening is these private enterprises are undermining the authority of national governments in countries like France that perceive themselves at sort of the apex of the international legal system.
How does it really amount to a challenge to sovereignty? Take us into that, Jane. I mean, we think about, okay, it's Google, you're doing search, or it's Facebook, you're talking with your friends, and suddenly you've got issues of national sovereignty and government control on the table.
Well, the difference between business activity that happens in the economy and government activity that happens in the public sphere is more a matter of social convention. It's not a immutable, timeless, universal distinction. And so what's happened in recent decades with the explosion of global supply chains and the global information economy is that businesses can project themselves into national societies in a way that wasn't possible before. And as they become active in local economies, local societies, their interactions with their customers have a regulatory dimension. They're setting the policies for how their customers interact with the service provider, how the customers interact with each other, and that's a regulatory function.
Well, take that down to individual companies and what that might mean with a Google or a Facebook or an Amazon.
So the right to be forgotten that Nicholas was talking about is a great example. In the United States, we have the weakest level of information privacy protection of any advanced economy. And Americans are comfortable with that because it reflects our sort of consumerist culture. But other countries are not comfortable with that. So when an American tech giant builds its platform for interacting with advertisers, for interacting with searchers, it doesn't have to factor in a high level of information privacy protection. And when people from other countries like Europe that has some of the highest information privacy protections in the world go across borders and access Google, they're eroding the level of privacy protection that they enjoy because they're using that American service. Mm-hmm. And so the countries in Europe have said that they're going to consider that that service is provided within their geographical territories in Europe, and Google is going to have to retrofit a high level of information privacy protection onto the technology platform it originally engineered in the United States low protection context.
We've got different ways of framing this and pursuing it in different arenas. In India, there's been a lot of talk lately about digital colonialism. Facebook came in there looking to implement its Free Basics program, where you get free mobile internet use as part of a Facebook program. India pushed back on that, saying, you know, wait a minute, sort of reaching over our shoulder. And that was supposed to be the next billion web users Mark Zuckerberg was talking about. In China, all kinds of restraints on the use of American software now, not just in what Europe might call the frightful five. They're looking out there at Intel and Oracle and EMC, this whole policy of DIOE, as in other words, get out of these the clutches, as they might see it, of these companies. Part of this we read about, Jane, flowed after the Edward Snowden revelations about how American tech companies might be an avenue for the national, the NSA and intelligence services in the U.S. to look into other countries' business.
I think the Edward Snowden affair certainly made the issues related to the relationship between companies based in the United States and U.S. government policy a lot more visible to the public through the mass media. But I think countries like India and China, just like European countries, policymakers in those countries have been aware of these issues for a long time. And Nicholas was talking about how the French have traditionally understood themselves as a superpower, that they're one of the fountainheads of culture and civilization and leadership in the world community. And India and China perceive themselves the same way. They may not be perceived that way by ordinary citizens in the United States. But those are countries that were classically great. They suffered a diminution under colonialism and imperialism, and now they're resurgent. And they're both acutely conscious of the need to defend their sovereignty. And they both, India and China, have government policies of using technology innovation as engines for growth. So in addition to the example involving Facebook offering to provide basic internet service to Indian citizens as a non-governmental charitable activity getting pushback, one of the contexts that I've studied is electronic payments. And in Europe and in the United States, one of these global giants that countries have struggled with to control with regulation is the payment card networks led by Visa and MasterCard. So in the United States, Walmart has repeatedly sued, you know, leading the retail merchants has repeatedly sued Visa and MasterCard to try and force them to become more accountable to the merchant stakeholders that pay all the fees that make the system run. DG Competition, Directorate General of Competition in the European Commission, has fought with Visa and MasterCard for decades, trying to make them more accountable to the business interests that pay for the whole system. And the story in United States and Europe is not a very encouraging one. Recently, in the European Union, the Commission has imposed price caps, mandatory pricing limitations on Visa and MasterCard because they wouldn't voluntarily engage with the merchant community and come to an understanding about reasonable fees. So China and India have watched that. They've watched the ability of the Commission of the European Union and the United States legal system, the inability to bring Visa and MasterCard under regulatory control. And the response in China and India has been to build their own credit card networks. So the China UnionPay card network is only barely a decade old. It's now number two in the world. It's larger than the MasterCard network. So China has built its own payment card network, and Visa and MasterCard will never be able to achieve the same level of market dominance in the Chinese domestic market that they did in Europe and America and a lot of countries. And furthermore, now they have to contend with a global competitor, which is China UnionPay.
So what do you see in this, if it's a global struggle between this transformative power and control of these very large tech giants, of the technology itself in a way, a struggle between that and or them and sovereign governments, who's winning, Jane? Is the vision of a world in which the internet kind of runs by its own rules all over the place, in which American companies dominated for so long, is that fading?
Well, national governments have a range of choices. They can interact with these tech giants in a lot of different ways. And so if a national government wants to pursue sort of a scorched earth policy and insist that they have command and control authority over global tech giants, all that's going to happen is they're going to reduce the access of their citizens to the benefits of participating in the global information economy. What governments in Europe, acting through the Commission, have tried to do is they've tried to require these global giants, technology giants, to internalize regulatory norms that embody the European way of life. For example, stronger data protection rules, stronger consumer protection rules. So that increases the cost of doing business of the European tech giants, of the American tech giants, and it provides European citizens with an online environment that matches their expectations. The problem is that the competition to control the tech giants is not only about maintaining sovereignty with regard to law. The question is, where is the employment that's associated with the growth in those industries? And so if European citizens all access, you know, the GAFA or the GAFAM services.
The big American giants, yeah.
Right. The employment is concentrated in the United States, China, and India. And the Europeans are just passive consumers. What the European governments are struggling to do is accelerate the pace of innovation and create innovation ecosystems in Europe. The big question in countries like France is, like, why isn't there a French Google? If French culture is as dynamic and important as French would like to believe it is, then there should be French equivalents of these global multinational corporations participating in the leadership of the global information economy. And China is one of the only countries that we think of as sort of emerging that's clearly playing in the top ranks. The Alibaba e-business platform is at least as important as, you know, Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon in its sector. I just mentioned the China UnionPay card is now the number two payment card in the world. India doesn't have any platforms that are yet successful outside of India. They're building their own card platform called RuPay, which is designed both to make sure that the needs of, you know, the Indian economy for payment services are met in a way that's compatible with Indian government policy. And there was a concern that Visa and MasterCard might not be team players in helping to execute, you know, Indian government policies in terms of financial inclusion. So governments have different strategies. They can engage in collaboration with these platforms to develop a framework so that their fundamental social and legal norms are respected, or they can take a further step, which is to accelerate the rate of innovation and entrepreneurship in their own economies and try and take advantage of the same opportunities that these American companies have seized to leverage, you know, the global information economy to promote economic development in their own countries.
I want to look more closely at what's happening in China, and we will do that in a moment. Nicholas Hurst, I want to ask you about the global business models of these U.S. giants and how they hold up against this resistance or these new expectations. But we have a lot of callers as well. Let me get one right here from Montreal in Canada. Brian, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I don't want to preach or teach America lessons, but even so close to America as Quebec, which speaks French and English, business practices that are unquestionably correct for America just don't fit. And I'm going to refer to the desktop universe because I've never left it. That's all I've ever needed. Mm-hmm. Whenever you buy a license for any software, such as a Microsoft operating system or a Microsoft Office application, you buy a license for a single language, English. That's my native language.
Yep.
Here in Quebec, I need to be able to use French as often and as fluidly as English. To get access to the French fonts and the French way of writing letters and French everything, you got to buy an entirely second license. It's as if the first piece of software license didn't exist. That's a fine assumption to make inside America, where English, e pluribus unum, is your way of life. But it ain't the way of life anywhere else, and the more people are migrating, like the Middle East crises right now, the less the American perspective will apply to the rest of the world.
And there's there's one little example. Sorry, Brian, you're saying?
I'm just saying America's business leaders may know that for their own experience, but they need to put it into their software because that's the way the rest of the world lives.
Brian, we've got it, and I appreciate just there's just one angle on it out of Montreal, and you can imagine, multiply that by many, many angles. Of course, I'm sure those American firms would like to ideally accommodate and continue to dominate. Tracy in Boston, what do you think, Tracy? You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I think regardless of what country you reside in, people will pick the online platform that serves their purpose du jour, serves their objectives. I live in a world of community enablement for the enterprise, and there are extremely robust platforms for online collaboration, for knowledge sharing. And in my opinion, I think it happens to be that, you know, Google launched, Facebook launched, these are incredibly powerful platforms.
Yep.
There's a reason why people are drawn to them, and that they won't be dominant forever. Nothing is, and let the market do what it will to solve, in my industry, business issues because it connects people and creates a knowledge sharing that wouldn't happen otherwise.
Tracy, I get that perspective completely, and it is, of course, powerful, but it does sort of presume that the market is going to be the milieu for this, that governments don't step in and create barriers. That, you know, I mean, customer choice, if that's there, they may well go for you. But what we're seeing here is government saying, wait a minute. Do you see hurdles coming up?
Oh, I definitely see hurdles, but I see hurdles because of, like your guest had indicated earlier, the regulations in Europe are considerably more stringent for privacy laws. In my world, that is an extreme barrier for solving business problems. And I talk to people day in and day out that they are inhibited from employing these online collaboration platforms because they simply can't get their IT department to give them access to them, and that puts them at a competitive disadvantage.
Tracy, I appreciate your call. Nicholas Hurst, we just have a minute before the break, but what do you think will dominate in Europe, consumer choice or these government sovereignty and more concerns that may create regulatory new regulatory, see it how you like, hurdles or comforts?
Well, I think there's going to be an accommodation event. I mean, there's always going to be an accommodation. I think, as was rightly pointed out, people are big fans of these platforms and the services and so on. And I think that it's probably when you look at these tech giants from the US, they're not so concerned as about European regulators as they are about each other and missing a trick and letting the other one be the first to arrive at the new invention or the new advance. That's, I think, what they're most worried about.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about global pushback against American tech industry giants, Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, and more, as countries look to protect their own industry and sovereignty from the dominance of American, huge tech players. You can join us this hour. Can you see why they might want to do that? Did you think the internet would go global forever with American companies leading the way? But what happens to America's economic future if these giants can't be fully global? Is it too early to concede that? Maybe there's a way to accommodate and work with all this. Maybe there's not. Nicholas Hurst is with us, reporter for Politico Europe, joins us today from Brussels. Jane Wynn, professor of law at the University of Washington, is with us, author of The Law of Electronic Commerce. She's an expert in the impact of tech innovation on national legal systems. With us right now as well from Washington is Scott Kennedy. He's just come back from the U.S.-China Innovation Dialogue in China. He's director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Scott Kennedy, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
So in Europe, it seems to be largely about privacy came first and maybe culture came first. In China, from the outside, it looks as though it's about protecting space for Chinese competitors to grow and thrive. What are American tech giants running up against there in terms of Chinese pushback?
I say it's both the type of issues that they're facing in Europe in terms of choice and privacy. But more than that, the Chinese government is quite concerned about national security and also about promoting Chinese technology champions. And so both of those motivations are driving the Chinese government to adopt a whole bunch of policies to constrain foreign players, particularly American companies, to have them share their technology, to create room for domestic Chinese competitors, and to require all tech companies, domestic and foreign, to provide access to the data and the networks that they are involved in.
And this isn't subtle. I was talking with somebody who's just back from China in a big American tech firm, IT, saying when they go out now, they really, Chinese firms just on direction from the Communist Party, from the Chinese government, they will not buy many American IT packages, for example. They have kind of standing orders to get out of that, to look for a Chinese alternative.
Mm. Well, I would say up to this point, American tech companies are still doing relatively well in China in a whole variety of areas. Qualcomm sells about half of its chips in China. And many of them are doing well, including IBM and others. But yes, the broader trend is growing difficulties with the Chinese government and in those type of orders, which are some informal, some quite formal. Chinese just came out with regulations for their insurance sector, which says insurance companies operating in China need to have secure and controllable technologies, which mean Chinese technologies going forward that are accessible by the Chinese government.
Secure and controllable. That I feel a kind of ambivalence about that. Secure sounds good. Controllable. In China's case, that control can be pretty heavy-handed. Let's get our callers in here again. Port Fourchon, Louisiana. Milan is calling. Milan, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going there, Tom?
Well, what do you think, Milan?
Well, let's see. I think that this should be a lesson to all the American tech companies that we need to raise the bar. You know, and I commend France for coming out and the other countries coming out and pushing against the big tech companies. Because, you know, I don't think it hurts just the economy in France and in China. I think it also hurts us here in America. You know, if you look at what Amazon's done to the book market and to many other markets here in America, I think it's up to us to innovate and push against these tech companies to make them raise the bar, increase regulations to help protect us, and make a better service, make a better product. I mean, I can't tell you how annoying it is to get that update for Windows 10 all the time, and things are pain in the ass. Excuse my language.
I mean, you may be right, but if this is the world that's coming, I mean, in China, they shut down Apple's iBooks and iTunes movie store there, but I can only imagine there'll be Chinese competitors who will be bringing in their own versions of that. I don't know, Scott. I've got an email here or a tweet on Twitter from Cole who says, was living in China when they blocked Google, Facebook, Twitter. Sucked for my productivity, but I think the locals barely noticed. Does it necessarily mean something better for Chinese consumers?
If the alternative Chinese products were better, if they protected privacy better, then I could see the argument for doing that. But I think what the Chinese are just saying is not that they want those things. They just want there to be the Chinese alternatives to the American products. The main search engine that's used in China, for example, Baidu, which has over 95% of the market, is a horrible search engine, but it only has that control because Google is essentially blocked in China, as are the other foreign search engines. And it's a far less competitive product. And so that's why in China, VPNs, virtual private networks, are so common, so that people can access the global internet, even though legally they're barred from doing so.
Here, Goderbeck writes to us online, says Tencent, which operates social networks in China, has Chinese police authorities sitting in their offices monitoring users' posts. Baidu, which you just mentioned, the search outfit, and Tencent operate as protectorates of the Chinese Communist Party and steal their business model from successful U.S. tech companies. Jane Nguyen in Washington, that's an America First kind of view of what's going on here. But what about the business models of these American giants? I mean, the internet was pretty much premised on this being a global undertaking.
There's no question that the first wave of popular adoption of the internet that started in the mid-1990s had a very liberal market, Anglo-Saxon orientation. So in Europe, it's conventional to refer to countries like the United Kingdom, Canada, United States, Australia, New Zealand as quote-unquote Anglo-Saxon. Mm. And we have a strong cultural preference for bottom-up, market-driven, individualistic solutions, limited government intervention. So the first wave of popularization of the internet, because the United States was the anchor in terms of the technology innovation and the diffusion of technology, strongly favored our model. In the subsequent decades, you know, the Europeans, the Chinese, the Indians have articulated alternative policies. And so now there's a shift towards having to factor into the development of the technology respect for various cultural norms, respect for various legal norms. And to the extent that, for example, the Chinese and the Europeans can coordinate their efforts to have a more managed internet experience, it's going to be very difficult for the United States to maintain its lead with the bottom up. The United Nations facilitated a dialogue called the World Summit on Information Society, mm-hmm. and the agenda was basically to challenge American hegemony, American leadership in the underlying cultural and political norms that were being disseminated through the internet. So resistance is mobilizing and it's becoming more organized, and in all likelihood, in the future, communications networks are going to be subject to more government control.
Your colleague there at the University of Washington, Dongshan Tan, says his assumption is that this is only the beginning. Quoting him here, talking with Farhad Manjoo of the New York Times, saying we'll be seeing more of these governments making their own demands, and the problem is a fragmentation of the global tech companies. He says this could be a problem for America in the 21st century. Nicholas Hurst there in Brussels, I'll put this to you as well, Scott, but I mean, Americans saw a lot of manufacturing go abroad, steel production go abroad. If the fundamental assumptions about how tech is going to work get fragmented and changed, do you see that as a problem for the U.S. economy in this century, Nicholas?
Yes, but I think that that's something that actually a lot of regulators out there and a lot of politicians are quite keen to avoid, because at least here in Brussels, there's a lot of talk now about the senses that the old internet economy is lost to Europe. The American tech firms, these great companies, have really sort of stolen a march on that, and cannot really be challenged from scratch. But there's a lot of looking towards the future, and there's a lot of talk of the industrial internet and connected devices, and what maybe the next phase of innovation or economic development might be. And so there's a lot of thinking about how Europe can make the most of that forthcoming revolution, which might involve a lot of sort of technology and industry. And
the Internet of Things.
The Internet of Things, exactly. Mm-hmm. And of course, to have, and regulators here are very conscious, just like they are in the US, that you have an Internet of Things that works, and that where devices can talk to each other and you've got interoperability and so on, then you need to have some sort of common standards. You need to have a high degree, actually, of standardization and cooperation to make that work. So I think that there is this kind of, there is a strong desire to avoid too much fragmentation going forward, just so long as, at least here in Europe, we can get a share of that future internet economy and do better in that than we've done in the last internet revolution.
Scott, well, how do you see the implications of this for the United States looking forward if it's not going to be so much a global market, but different requirements and restrictions and regulations for all kinds of reasons, some maybe quite legitimate? What does it mean for the U.S. economy when this is the leading edge of the U.S. economy, the firms we're talking about in many ways?
I think it's actually going to be just fine. There's no reason there has to be a one-size-fits-all solution for the internet for the world. And these companies are quite adaptable to different markets. They have people that work on the ground from those countries that can customize and tailor the products and adapt their solutions. And there's already a pretty vast, wide, diverse ecosystem for the internet. Just the point is we shouldn't go overboard on that and kill the internet for some of these reasons. And some of the things that the Chinese are doing are going to make the internet far less useful for everybody if taken to their extreme.
That sounds to an American ear like a limit on the promise of the internet.
It certainly does. And the way the discussion has gone this hour, in some ways it sounds like it's the U.S. versus the world. But in fact, when high-tech companies go to China, they actually – all the foreign companies are on the same page. The insurance regulations that I just mentioned a few minutes ago, there was a letter written by 28 industry associations complaining about those new rules signed by industry associations from the U.S., Europe, and Japan. So this is a multi-front contest involving different alliances in different locations depending on the specific issue.
Jane Wynn, I guess this really does illuminate why we saw so much concern in Silicon Valley about the revelations from Edward Snowden about the NSA, how they were sometimes cooperating or using some of these giants' capacity to do their intelligence gathering. When you put that stamp on these companies, that sort of gives a passport to foreign governments to go in there and start asking for changes.
Yes, and I think that one of the reasons that the tech companies have mobilized in such a visible and vocal way against the demands in connection with the terrorist attacks in San Bernardino, California, mm-hmm. to provide the keys to get access to the smartphones of the individuals responsible.
Well, Apple resisted mightily and publicly for a long time there.
Correct. And I think the tech community generally has used that as an opportunity to send out the message globally that they're going to fight for individual user rights and they're going to resist these kinds of efforts. But I think ultimately in a modern global information ecosystem, citizens share the concern of governments with controlling terrorism. And so Nicholas was talking about the need for standardization, the need to collaborate on developing international standards. So there's a fundamental conflict between national security and these new business models unless and until we can negotiate a framework that respects the needs of, entrepreneurship and innovation on the one hand, and the needs of citizens to be secure in their homes and as they travel around the world. So that's where there needs to be a collaborative dialogue between these representatives of industry and governments to coordinate to find appropriate solutions to those problems.
There was a time, Jane, when the sort of common meme was that borders would come down in the internet age, governments would lose power, and power would sort of go via these companies in some way to the people. How do you look at that formulation now?
Again, I think that the power to the people is going to be less ad hoc, informal, spontaneous, bottom up. It's going to be mediated through more sophisticated technology solutions that are transparent and open, that the work of the tech giants to localize their products and to accommodate different requirements is a form of empowerment for the citizens in those countries that share their government's view about, for example, the importance of information privacy.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not any requirement that localization produce fragmentation if the process of localization is facilitated through a dialogue and through transparency and through standards.
Nicholas, last word to you. In Europe, do they feel like they're getting more of a handle on what has been called the Frightful Five or GAFAM here, Google, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft and more? Do they feel like they're moving the needle, getting a hand on the reins?
To be honest, I don't get that feeling round here. I think that the problem that they face is that these companies have completely rewritten the rules of the economy, of technology, and it's very difficult to work out how the old laws and principles and so on apply to these new business models and these new methods of doing business. And I think the test of time will probably be whether in 10 years' time we're talking about the Frightful Five from Europe who are invading the U.S. and taking market share there.
That would be a revolution. It's going to be fascinating to watch, however it turns out. Nicholas Hurst with Politico Europe joining us today from Brussels. Thank you very much for your time and insights, Nicholas.
Thank you very much.
Jane Wynn at the University of Washington, professor of law there. Jane, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And Scott Kennedy at the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Scott, welcome back from China, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.